Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in February of 2025. Here are a few of the articles that we'll have time for, I'm sure. Trump's campaign to dismantle the government. America's marriage material shortage. What it takes to make flying safe. And the tasks of an anti-Trump coalition. And hopefully we'll have time for one or two additional articles. So I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with this article, Trump's campaign to dismantle the government. The president is pursuing the long-standing conservative goal of neutralizing the federal bureaucracy. By Franklin Foer. Over the decades, the American right has deployed violent imagery to describe its highest ideological goal: drown government in a bathtub, starve the beast, slash and burn. In less than 2 weeks of organized chaos, the Trump administration has realized these fantasies, but by deploying tactics both more subtle and more sinister than the movement's old guard ever imagined. Rather than eliminating departments wholesale or depleting the budgets of agencies, it has relied on menacing gestures. By arbitrarily placing civil servants on probation, reclassifying bureaucratic positions as political appointments, freezing grant spending, floating a deferred resignation offer by mass email, and firing high-profile federal prosecutors and inspectors general, the administration has created the impression that it is making preparations for a mass purge of the government. Some of these moves are transparent provocations, trolling by executive order, that press the limits of the law and will be slapped away by the courts. But it may not matter. This psychological gamemanship might obviate the need for an actual purge, because its tactics have been conceived to prod a huge chunk of the civil service to exit on its own accord. In Washington, this is an intensely local story. At the stations of everyday existence, the coffee shop, the gym, the bookstore, I keep encountering longtime civil servants who are either scrambling to leave their jobs or considering that possibility. They vent how they can't live in a state of terminal anxiety. They resent being treated as if they were somehow derelict, despite decades of demonstrable competence. Even lower-level bureaucrats describe a dread of being fired for once having said the wrong thing at a conference. Some of them vow to stay, but their faces betray fear. I worry that they won't resist the bullying. Military service is justifiably venerated because it involves potential physical sacrifice on society's behalf. The civil service engenders pretty much the opposite reaction. Bureaucracy is synonymous in Western culture with pettiness, excessive fastidiousness, and the arbitrary wielding of unaccountable power. Anyone who has dealt with the federal government knows of its imperfections. Whatever those flaws, the civil service is also worthy of respect that the culture fails to accord it. I'm constantly amazed how many sharp, smart professionals idealistically commit to careers in government with the knowledge that they will earn far less than they would at, say, a law firm or in management consulting. With long careers, they acquire expertise in archaic but essential fields: poultry exports, vaccine policy, the administration of economic sanctions. Their wisdom makes fair-minded governance possible. They work in organizations that are sometimes maddening on behalf of political leaders whom they don't always support. For the most part, they endure the annoyances of their jobs because they believe in the underlying mission of their departments and agencies. Missions they have good reason to suspect are now being snuffed out by Donald Trump's draconian new personnel policies. One of the abject failures of Joe Biden's presidency was that he did not proselytize for his own faith in institutions, which he considered the essential bulwarks against autocracy. Institutionalism is a counterintuitive proposition. Bureaucrats are trained to be responsive to political leaders, but not beholden to them. When bureaucrats publish economic data, their allegiance is to empirical reality, not the presidents who might benefit from rosy reports. When they apply regulation, they typically avoid the impulse to enrich cronies. Sometimes the process is creaky, but it's that process that expresses the high ideal that the state's power must be neutrally applied. And this high ideal is part of the reason that so much of the world trusts the United States with its investments and capital. Over the course of a career, individuals become vassals of the culture of the institutions they inhabit, and they transmit that culture to newcomers. That's something that the new administration clearly understands. By chasing out personnel, Trump and his allies are destroying the habits of government. They are crushing the civil service's sense of purpose, the commitment that inspires dedication to studious neutrality. Nobody would invent government institutions as they currently exist, but that's their strength. Their culture emerges from the long histories of organizations, developed organically over time, prodded by moments of legislative reform, largely resistant to the fads of the moment. This is not something that returns with an orientation session, or even the next change of administration. The wrecking ball should inspire humility. In an afternoon, timeless fixtures of a landscape can be reduced to scrap and dust. What's destroyed is a flash of ideological fervor, at the behest of a president who abhors dissent, can't be so easily replaced, if at all. That's the end of the article. The author, Franklin Foer, is a staff writer at The Atlantic. The title of his article was Trump's Campaign to Dismantle the Government. The second article is America's Marriage Material Shortage. Adults are significantly less likely to be married or to live with a partner than they used to be, by Derek Thompson. Perhaps you've heard, young people aren't dating anymore. News media and social media are awash in commentary about the decline in youth romance. It's visible in the corporate data, with dating app engagement taking a hit. And it's visible in the survey data, where the share of 12th graders who say they've dated has fallen from about 85% in the 1980s to less than 50% in the early 2020s, with the decline particularly steep in the past few years. Naturally, young people's habits are catnip to news commentators. But although I consider the story of declining youth romance important, I don't find it particularly mysterious. In my essay on the anti-social century, I reported that young people have retreated from all manner of physical world relationships. whether because of smartphones, over-parenting, or a combination of factors. Compared with previous generations of teens, they have fewer friends, spend significantly less time with the friends they do have, attend fewer parties, and spend much more time alone. Romantic relationships theoretically imply a certain physicality, so it's easy to imagine that the collapse of physical world socializing for young people would involve the decline of romance. Adults have a way of projecting their anxieties and realities onto their children. In the case of romance, the fixation on young people masks a deeper, and to me far more mysterious, phenomenon. What is happening to adult relationships? American adults are significantly less likely to be married or to live with a partner than they used to be. The national marriage rate is hovering near its all-time low, while the share of women under 65 who aren't living with a partner has grown steadily since the 1980s. The past decade seems to be the only period since at least the 1970s when women under 35 were more likely to live with their parents than with a spouse. People's lives are diverse, and so are their wants and desires and circumstances. It's hard and perhaps impossible to identify a tiny number of factors that explain hundreds of millions of people's decisions to couple up, split apart, or remain single. But according to Lyman Stone, a researcher at the Institute for Family Studies, the most important reason marriage and coupling are declining in the U.S. is actually quite straightforward. Many young men are falling behind economically. A marriage or romantic partnership can be many things: friendship, love, sex, someone to gossip with, someone to remind you to take out the trash. But practically speaking, Stone told me, marriage is also insurance. Women have historically relied on men to act as insurance policies against the threat of violence, the risk of poverty. To some, this might sound like an old-fashioned, even reactionary description of marriage, but its logic still applies. Men's odds of being in a relationship today are still highly correlated with their income, Stone said. Women do not typically invest in long-term relationships with men who have nothing to contribute economically. In the past few decades, young and especially less educated men's income has stagnated, even as women have charged into the workforce and seen their college graduation rates soar. For single, non-college-educated men, average inflation-adjusted earnings at age 45 have fallen by nearly 25% in the past half-century, while for the country as a whole, average real earnings have more than doubled. As a result, a lot of young men today just don't look like what women have come to think of as marriage material, he said. In January, the Financial Times' John Byrne Murdoch published an analysis of the relationship recession that lent strong support to Stone's theory. Contrary to the idea that declining fertility in the U.S. is mostly about happy, childless DINKs, dual income, no-kid couples, the drop in relationship formation is steepest among the poorest, he observed. I asked Byrne Murdoch to share his analysis of current population survey data so that I could take a closer look. What I found is that in the past 40 years, coupling has declined more than twice as fast among Americans without a college degree compared with college graduates. This represents a dramatic, historic inversion. In 1980, Americans aged 25 to 34 without a bachelor's degree were more likely than college graduates to get married. Today, it's flipped, and the education gap in coupling is widening every year. Marriage produces wealth by pooling two people's income, but conversely, wealth also produces marriage. Contraception technology might also play a role. Before cheap birth control became widespread in the 1970s, sexual activity was generally yoked to commitment. It was a cultural norm for a man to marry a girl if he'd gotten her pregnant, and single parenthood was uncommon. But as the married economists George Akerlof and Janet Yellen observed in a famous 1996 paper, contraception helped disentangle sex and marriage. Couples could sleep together without any implicit promise to stay together. Ultimately, Akerlof and Yellen posit the availability of contraception, which gave women the tools to control the number and the timing of their kids, decimated the tradition of shotgun marriages, and therefore contributed to an increase in children born to low-income, single parents. The theory that the relationship recession is driven by young men falling behind seems to hold up in the U.S. But what about around the world? Rates of coupling are declining throughout Europe as well. In England and Wales, the marriage rate for people under 30 has declined by more than 50% since 1990. And it's not just Europe. The gender researcher Alice Evans has shown that coupling is down just about everywhere. In Iran, annual marriages plummeted by 40% in 10 years. Some Islamic authorities blame Western values and social media for the shift. They might have a point. When women are exposed to more Western media, Evans argues, their life expectations expand. Fitted with TikTok and Instagram and other windows into Western culture, young women around the world can seek the independence of a career over the codependency, or worse, the outright loss of freedom, that might come with marriage in their own country. Social media, a woman veterinarian in Tehran told the Financial Times, also glamorizes the single life by showing how unmarried people lead carefree and successful lives. People keep comparing their partners to mostly fake idols on social platforms. According to Evans, several trends are driving this global decline in coupling. Smartphones and social media may have narrowed many young people's lives, pinning them to their couches and bedrooms. But they've also opened up women's minds to the possibility of professional and personal development. When men fail to support their dreams, relationships fail to flourish, and the sexes drift apart. If I had to sum up this big, messy story in a sentence, it would be this. Coupling is declining around the world as women's expectations rise and lower-income men's fortunes fall. This combination is subverting the traditional role of straight marriage, in which men are seen as necessary for the economic insurance of their family. So why does this all matter? Two of the more urgent sociological narratives of this moment are declining fertility and rising unhappiness. The relationship recession makes contact with both. First, marriage and fertility are tightly interconnected. Unsurprisingly, one of the strongest predictors of declining fertility around the world is declining coupling rates, as Bern Murdoch has written. Second, marriage is strongly associated with happiness. According to general social survey data, Americans' self-described life satisfaction has been decreasing for decades. In a 2023 analysis of the GSS data, the University of Chicago economist Sam Peltzman concluded that marriage was more correlated with this measure of happiness than any other variable he considered, including income. As Stone would rush to point out here, marriage itself is correlated with income. The social crisis of our time is not just that Americans are more socially isolated than ever, but also that social isolation is rising alongside romantic isolation, as the economic and cultural trajectories of men and women move in opposite directions. And perhaps most troubling, the Americans with the least financial wealth also seem to have the least social wealth, so to speak. It is the poor who might especially need the support of friends and partners, who have the fewest close friends and the fewest long-term partners. Money might not buy happiness, but it can buy the things that buy happiness. That completes the article. The author, Derek Thompson, is a staff writer at The Atlantic. His article was titled America's Marriage Material Shortage. I'll take a moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is The Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of The Atlantic, all of them published in February of 2025. The next article is What It Takes to Make Flying Safe. Near misses and accidents have to do with the whole system of aviation management, by Laura Kelly. Wednesday night's deadly airplane crash was tragic, and to many experts, not altogether surprising. The collision between a commercial airplane and a military helicopter in Washington, D.C., has led many people to take a closer look at the complex systems that commercial flying relies on, and the strain that some of those systems are under. I spoke with my colleague, Ian Bogost, who writes often about the airline industry, about the factors that shape our perceptions of flying. Laura Kelly. This incident is not an aberration, but rather something experts seem to have seen coming. What are some of the warning signs? Ian. Aviation experts had been fearing that something like this would happen, not just at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, but all across the country. Near misses have been on the rise, as have runway incursions, planes accidentally sharing the same space with other planes. I won't pretend to understand all of the reasons for that, and that's part of the problem. The issues here aren't as simple as something like screws falling off. Rather, near misses and accidents have to do with the whole system of aviation management, pilot experience, air traffic control staffing, the number of planes in the air, the complex airspace around Washington, D.C., in this case. More Americans are flying, too, and growing demand puts new pressure on all of these systems in invisible ways. Laura, how should people think about flying at this moment? Ian, commercial airlines want you to feel comfortable flying because their business depends on it. The evolution of commercial air travel, especially in America, has made it so you don't even have to look at or smell or hear the equipment to the same extent that passengers once did. You're protected from many things that reminded you that you're in a machine hurtling through the air at 500 miles per hour. commercial air travel really is quite safe. When I say commercial air travel, I mean when you fly a major carrier on a scheduled flight that's regulated. Safety in the cabin has also improved. Flight attendants worked very hard over many decades to establish themselves as safety professionals and not just service staff. The flight crew is trained to act in case of an emergency, and they're highly prepared to do so. But because travel is so safe, you never get to see them perform that expertise. God forbid you see them perform that expertise. Laura, airlines are quite consolidated, and the system of flight relies on a range of factors beyond just individual companies. How does consolidation factor into safety? Ian, we have fewer choices in flight than we used to. Fewer airlines, fewer routes, fewer airport hubs. That does have an impact on safety. One way this plays out is if you have fewer options for direct flights, you might have to opt for a layover. Takeoffs and landings are the most dangerous part of air travel, so if you can reduce takeoffs and landings, for example by taking one flight instead of two, you're safer, at least statistically. This is all still safer than driving somewhere in a car. It's really difficult for consumers to make rational decisions about safety today, especially because we don't really know what happened yet with this incident. We don't know how great the risk is of it happening again. I've heard people start to consider making changes to their habits, although I don't think we're going to see many folks change their plans in the long run. After a door plug blew off during an Alaska Airlines flight last year, I started to see people saying they would try to avoid the aircraft in question, a Boeing 737-9 MAX. Are these people actually safer? Who knows? Laura, why do people often pin their safety fears on airplanes themselves rather than focusing on the people or systems that operate them? Ian, in the case of flying, people tend to target their concern toward the concrete, visceral problems they can see and touch. Is there a screw loose? Is my seat broken? We mostly don't consider the more systemic, intangible ones, such as staffing issues and maintenance routines and airspace traffic patterns. When an accident like this week's happens, however, we get a brief insight into just how complex modern life is. For all of us, it's certainly much easier not to have to think about that complexity. That completes the article, What It Takes to Make Flying Safe, by Laura Kelly. The title of the next article is The Tasks of an Anti-Trump Coalition. Avoid progressive pieties and rebuild an effective Democratic majority, by David Frum. Donald Trump threatening to annex Canada? It was an absurd situation. I briefly considered recycling an old joke of mine about merging all of the High Plains states into a single province of South Saskatchewan. But as I toyed with it, the joke soured. The President of the United States was bellowing aggression against fellow democracies. The situation was simultaneously too stupid for serious journalism and too shameful for wisecracks. In this second Trump presidency, many of us are baffled by how to respond. The former Trump strategist Steve Bannon memorably described Trump's method as flood the zone with shit. Try to screen all the flow and you will rapidly exhaust yourself and desensitize your audience. Ignore the flood and soon you're immersed in the stuff neck deep. More than 1 million people demonstrated against him on January 21st, 2017. many more than that had attended his inauguration the day before. On January 27, Trump issued an executive order purporting to ban Muslims from entering the United States. Thousands of people thronged airports across the nation to protest. About 100 were arrested. In less formal ways, civic-minded Americans also rallied against the new administration. They read and viewed more news and paid for it at record levels, too. Trump reviled one news organization more than any other, the, quote, failing New York Times. In 2017 alone, the company's revenues from digital subscriptions climbed 46%, pushing total company revenues above $1 billion. Meanwhile, the administration bumbled from fiasco to fiasco. Within the first week, Trump's choice of national security advisor lied to the FBI about his contacts with the Russian government, setting in motion his early resignation and then criminal indictment. Trump, that same week, summoned then-FBI Director James Comey to dinner to pressure him to end the Bureau's investigation of Trump-Russia connections. The demand would lead to Comey's firing, the appointment of a special counsel, and the prosecution and conviction of important Trump allies, such as Paul Manafort. First-term Trump knew what he wanted, unlimited personal power. But he did not know how to achieve it, and an insignificant number of those around him was willing and able to help him. The senior administration officials who supported Trump's autocratic ambitions lacked bureaucratic competence. The officials who possessed the bureaucratic competence did not support his ambitions. That's one reason it took Trump more than a year, until March 2018, to impose the first major round of the tariffs that he wanted, but his top economic advisor opposed. First-term Trump also lacked reliable partners in Congress. Then Speaker of the House Paul Ryan and then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell struck devil's bargains with Trump to achieve their own agendas: tax cuts, judicial appointments, the attempted repeal of Obamacare. But they were not his men. They overlooked his corruption, but also imposed limits on what he could do. In 2019, Trump tried to name two personal loyalists to the Federal Reserve Board. McConnell's Senate rejected them. Second-term Trump is very different. He has moved rapidly to consolidate power. Even before he took office, the Department of Justice preemptively stopped all legal actions against him for his attempted seizure of power on January 6, 2021. As soon as he was inaugurated, Trump pardoned or commuted the sentences of all of those convicted for the violent attack on Congress. He then announced investigations of the lawyers who had acted to enforce the law against him. Trump has moved rapidly to oust independent civil servants, beginning with 17 nonpartisan inspectors general. He moved fast to install loyalists atop the two most important federal management agencies, the Office of Management and Budget and the Office of Personnel Management. His administration is united in claiming power to refuse to spend funds already appropriated by Congress and to ignore laws that constrain the absolute power of the executive branch. The whole Trump team, not only the president personally, is testing another important tool of power: stopping congressionally approved grants to states to ensure that he is funding supporters and punishing opponents. The Trump administration retreated from the test after 2 days of uproar, but how permanently, who can say? Trump's administration has launched large-scale immigration raids in Democratic cities and commenced legal action against local officials who stand in the way. The administration has stopped all international humanitarian aid, cutting off Ukraine. Trump is backed, not undercut, by senior national security officials in his threats of territorial aggression against Greenland, Panama, and Canada. The Republican platform and congressional budget writers approve Trump's musings about replacing tax revenues with hoped-for windfalls from tariffs. Even his seemingly juvenile move to rename the Gulf of Mexico was immediately endorsed by the Department of the Interior. The absurd act carries an underlying serious message. The Trump administration stands behind its president's high-handed rewriting of rules, even the most established and uncontroversial. Looming ahead are even more crucial acts of consolidation, including the appointment of an FBI director who has proclaimed his willingness to use the federal police force as a tool of presidential personal power. Trump's opponents seem dazed, disoriented, and defeated. Despite the GOP's slender majorities in both chambers of Congress, and despite Trump's own low approval rating, the new White House, for the moment, carries all before it. There have been no mass protests. The demand for news and information, so voracious in 2017, has diminished, if not vanished. Audiences have dwindled. Once mighty news organizations are dismissing hundreds of journalists and staff. Compared with 8 years ago, Trump is winning more, and his opponents are resisting less. What's changed? 4 major things. First, this time Trump is not arriving in power alone. He and the Republican mainstream have merged, a convergence symbolized by the highly detailed Project 2025 plan written for Trump by the Heritage Foundation. Trump disavowed the plan during the campaign. He was lying when he did so. Now its authors are his most effective henchmen, and unlike the situation he faced in 2017, Trump can now combine expertise and loyalty in the same body of staffers. Second, this time Trump's opponents feel beaten in a way that they did not after 2016. That year, Hillary Clinton received nearly 3 million more votes than Trump. Clinton's popular vote advantage had no legal meaning. The office of the president is won or lost according to the arcane rules of the Electoral College, not by direct vote counting. Politically, though, the popular vote matters a lot. That's why Trump confected all those silly lies about his supposedly historic victory in 2016 and his allegedly enormous crowd size at the 2017 inauguration. Back then, Democrats felt outmaneuvered, but not outvoted. By contrast, Kamala Harris's unqualified loss in 2024 has crushed morale. Democrats are divided, criticizing one another for their loss, not yet united to stand the alarm about how Trump is using his victory. Third, Trump owes many of his early successes to previous Democratic mistakes. On issue after issue, immigration, enforcement, crime and public order, race and gender, Democratic governments over the past 8 years have drifted away from the mainstream of American public opinion. The drift is best symbolized by that notorious answer Harris gave to a 2019 questionnaire asking whether she favored taxpayer-funded gender transition operations for undocumented immigrants and federal prisoners. Her related response in an interview with a progressive group was like some kind of smart-aleck word puzzle. How many unpopular hot-button issues can be crammed into a single sentence? Harris believed that punching every one of those buttons was necessary to be a viable progressive in the 2019-20 cycle. She and America paid the price in 2024. A real quandary arises here. The best organized Democratic interest groups want to fight Trump on the worst possible issues. The Democrats who want to fight on smarter issues tend to be less organized to fight. Until that conundrum is solved, Democrats are disabled, and Trump is empowered. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the workforce? Not popular. Hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers entering the United States with little way to expel them if they are ultimately refused, as almost all of them will be? Even less popular. Create a rift between the United States and Israel? Very unpopular. Trans athletes competing in girls' and women's sports? Wildly unpopular. These are bad fights for Democrats to have. For that very reason, they are the fights that Trump Republicans want to start. Dangerously and unfortunately, they are also the fights that some of the most active of Democratic factions seek to have. The fourth difference between 2017 and 2025 is the difference in the information space in which American politics is conducted. In 2017, politically minded Americans used platforms like Facebook and Twitter to share links to news sources. Some of those sources were deceptive or outright fake, but even fake news at least replicated the form and style of actual news. Since then, new platforms have risen to dominance, especially among younger Americans and those less connected to politics. These new platforms are far more effective at detecting and manipulating user bias, fear, and anger. They are personality-powered, offering affirmation and bonding as their proofs of truth. For pro-Trump Republicans, this new information space is marvelously congenial. They love and hate based on personal recommendations, and will flit from issue to issue as their preferred influencers command. Such a movement centered on celebrity and charismatic leadership has no problem with the fact that its favorite media spread disinformation and distrust. In fact, it's useful. Trump has, in effect, adapted a slogan from Mussolini. Trump is always right. Its corollary is, only Trump is right. Nothing important is lost from a Trump point of view if right-wing media encourage their users to despise science, law, and other forms of expertise. The anti-Trump coalition, however, is all about institutions. It depends on media that promote understanding of and respect for the work that institutions do. The new media age is inherently inhospitable to institutionalists and deeply demoralizing for them. Before they can organize to resist Trump, they must build new ways of communicating that adapt to contemporary technology but do not succumb to that technology's politically destructive tendencies. All of the above takes time, but it all can be done and must be done. The second Trump administration has opened purposeful and strong. Its opponents have opened confused and weak. But today's brutal reality can be tomorrow's fading memory. The second-term Trump synthesis does not even pretend to have an economic agenda for middle-class people. The predictable next round of tax cuts will disfavor them. The ensuing deficits will keep mortgage rates high. The tariffs and immigration crackdowns will raise consumer prices. Trump is offering nothing to help with the cost of health care and college. Trump, using James Brown's "It's a Man's, Man's, Man's World" as his walk-on song, staffing his administration with accused abuser of women upon accused abuser of women, and relying heavily on reactionary anti-woman gender politics as his political message and messengers, all of that will exact a political price in weeks and months ahead. Trump himself will lead and epitomize an administration of rake-offs and graft. He may exceed in sabotaging laws designed to prevent and punish corruption in high offices. He won't be able to suppress awareness of his corruption. The second-term Trump world will bubble with threats to U.S. security. Trump is determined to make each of them worse by fracturing our alliances in both the Euro-Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific regions. The worst threat of all is that Trump will be drawn into military action inside Mexico without the cooperation of the Mexican authorities. Trump's project to brand drug cartels as international terrorist organizations has legal implications that Trump supporters refuse to consider. Right now, the cartels have powerful incentives not to commit violence against U.S. citizens or on U.S. territory. Yet Trump is poised on the verge of actions that could change the cartel's calculus and import Mexico's criminal violence north of the border on a huge scale. Trump won the election of 2024, but still failed to break 50% of the vote. His hold on Congress could slip at any time. His plans to foster voter ID laws and gerrymandering to disenfranchise Democrats will collide with the new reality of American politics that these measures will harm his prospects more than his opponents. Trump does best among the most disaffiliated Americans, whereas Democrats are widening their lead among those Americans who follow politics closely and vote most often. The most immediate task for the anti-Trump coalition in these early months of 2025 is to avoid more mistakes. President Joe Biden ended his presidency by listening to advice to grant clemency to thousands of drug offenders, including heinous murderers. Who offered that advice? Don't listen to them anymore. Fight Trump where he's most vulnerable, not where progressive interest groups are most isolated and most dogmatic. Build unity from the center rather than indulge the factionalism of the ultra-left. A great many Americans despise Trump for the basic reason that he's a very nasty person who speaks in demeaning ways and does cruel things. The movement to stop him should look and sound and act nice. If you get reprimanded for respectability politics, or caricatured as cringe, or scolded for appealing to suburban wine moms, that's when you'll know you're doing it right. The MAGA elite feels and fears the weight of American democracy. It knows that democratic accountability and action will grind down its authoritarian aspirations and corrupt schemes. The MAGA elite's best plan for success is to persuade the American majority to abandon hope and surrender the fight. Its most useful allies are the extremists, who have too often misled the great American center into doomed leftward detours. November 2024 was bad. January and February 2025 are worse. The story is not over yet. Unless you agree to lay down in despair the pen that can write the remainder of the story. And that completes the article. The title was The Tasks of an Anti-Trump Coalition by Atlantic staff writer David Frum. The title of our last article today is CDC Data Are Disappearing. The agency has already removed scientific data from public view. More could follow. By Catherine Wu. Last night, scientists began to hear cryptic and foreboding warnings from colleagues. Go to the CDC website and download your data now. They were all telling one another the same thing. Data on the website were about to disappear or be altered to comply with the Trump administration's ongoing attempt to scrub federal agencies of any mention of gender, DEI, and accessibility. I was up until 2 a.m. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan, who relies on the CDC's data to track viral outbreaks, told me. She archived whatever she could. What they feared quickly came to pass. Already, content from the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, which includes data from a national survey, has disappeared. So have parts of the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry's Social Vulnerability Index and the Environmental Justice Index. The CDC's landing page for HIV data has also vanished, and the agency's Atlas Plus tool, which contains nearly 20 years of CDC surveillance data on HIV, hepatitis, sexually transmitted infections, and tuberculosis, is down. Several scientists I talked with told me they had heard directly from contacts at the CDC that the agency had directed employees to scrub any mention of gender from its site and the data that it shares there, replacing it with sex. The full scope of the purge isn't yet clear. One document obtained by The Atlantic indicated that the government was, as of yesterday evening, intending to target and replace, at a minimum, several suggested key words, including pregnant people, transgender, binary, non-binary, gender, assigned at birth, binary, non-binary, cisgender, queer, gender identity, gender minority, anything with pronouns in CDC content. While these terms are often politicized, some represent demographic variables that researchers collect when tracking the ebb and flow of diseases and health conditions across populations. Should they be reworded or even removed entirely from data sets to comply with the executive order, researchers and healthcare providers might have a much harder time figuring out how diseases affect specific communities, making it more challenging to serve Americans on the whole. CDC data's explicit purpose is to guide researchers toward the places and people who most need attention. Patrick Sullivan, an epidemiologist at Emory University and a former CDC Epidemic Intelligence Service officer, told me. As the changes unfold before him, he said, it's hard to understand how this benefits health. When I contacted the CDC, a spokesperson redirected my requests for comment to the Department of Health and Human Services. After this story was published, an HHS spokesperson said that all changes to the HHS website and HHS division websites are in accordance with President Trump's January 20th executive orders on gender and DEI. The government appears to understand that these changes could have scientific implications. The document directing a review of CDC content suggests that some work could be altered without changing the meaning or scientific integrity of the content, and that any such changes should be considered routine. Changing other content, according to the document, would require review by an expert, precisely because any alterations would risk scientific integrity. But the document does not specify how data would be sorted into those categories, or at whose discretion. My fear is that in the short term, entire data sets would be taken down, then reappear with demographic variables removed or altered to conform with DEI restrictions, Katie Below, an epidemiologist at Brown, told me. Excising mention of gender and sexual orientation, for instance, from public health data sets could require stripping entire columns of data out. If the government chooses to define sex as binary, transgender people and non-binary people, among others, could be effectively erased. In response to the ongoing changes, some groups of researchers are now rushing to archive the CDC website in full. And with that, I am afraid we have run out of time. The name of this article was CDC Data Are Disappearing by Catherine Wu. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. The articles I've read today are from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of them were published in February of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if there's a program you miss that you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.